mother dies. "You're squeezing my hands a bit hard, Mummy," she said solemnly. "Sorry." I loosened my grip. "It's hard to explain how you can feel someone is still with you when they've gone to heaven, but you'll see. Okay?" She nodded, still looking a bit confused. I stood up and we started walking again. Tansy said, "Ellie said she heard her mummy and daddy talking, and her daddy said my daddy had a girlfriend and that it was Susie, Alex's mum." I stumbled slightly and steadied myself on a nearby tree. "No, that's not true. Listen to me, Tansy." Her eyes looked so blue and forlorn. "Your daddy hadn't got a girlfriend. He had me and you, and he loved us more than anything, no matter what nasty things people say. Okay?" Was this what people in the village were saying? That Michael was seeing Susie, and he must have had something to do with her disappearance? They didn't know about the evidence I'd found. For all I'd revised my opinion on Paul, it sounded as though he was far from being a true friend to us. I felt as though the villagers had turned against me too. I reached for my daughter's hand and began to walk, one foot in front of the other. "That's all I have to manage for now," I told myself. I kept having to defend my daughter's father, who was also a man I wasn't sure I knew anymore. The events of the last few weeks, Irene's comments about him and Susie, the police finding his keys in the cottage, the witness who said he'd stepped out into the road, the Ring door video footage, the phone business, all this had shaken everything I'd ever believed about him. But there was no space to think it through. I felt like events were flashing by at breakneck speed, and it was making me very nervous and very tense.
"Ellie is my bestest friend," Tansy said as she walked. "And I like Alex too, but he said he doesn't want to play with us anymore. He just stays on his own, looking sad."
The cottages came into view on the brow of the hill, and my heart jolted, like it might stop at any moment.
"Who's that in the field, Mummy?"
Tansy frowned as a middle-aged man walked up to the ride-on mower and climbed astride it. "I don't know. We'll ask Irene." There would never be a time when I didn't come here and think about Michael. Everything I saw reminded me of him. His office, the fields he loved to walk around at the end of each day, surveying the land for broken fences or patches of grass that needed attention. The dilemma was that Irene lived here, and she was a dear friend who'd cared about him too. And without Michael and Susie around, I knew she'd be struggling, so I had to make the effort. When we reached the house, Irene was sitting on the sofa, listening to a radio discussion programme, one of her legs propped up on a footstool. I sat down opposite her, and she turned the volume right down.
"The sciatica is better, but the arthritis has started up again in my left knee," she grumbled. "It won't leave me alone. I've hardly slept. Tansy, sweetheart, come over here."
She patted the seat cushion next to her, and Tansy obliged. Irene opened her wooden box and handed her a small Amazon package, earning herself a smile. "I'll make us a nice cup of tea," I said, shuffling to the edge of my seat. As Tansy opened the parcel, Irene looked at me.
"How are you both?"
"Oh, you know," I said, settling back down again with a sigh. "Managing to get through. I'm not quite sure how. Who's that out in the field?"
"That's a local farmer who knew Michael," she said sheepishly. "He kindly offered to help until I can sort things out here. I'm sorry you had to see him there, Kate. It must have brought back memories, but I'm not trying to replace Michael."
"No need to apologize," I said. "You can't afford to let the place slide, and Michael wouldn't have wanted you to. He poured his heart and soul into Wadebridge, and he'd have hated to think you were struggling."
"Thank you, Kate. It's a weight off my mind to know you're not offended."
Tansy held up a Play-Doh set.
"Look, Mummy, there are heart stencils with it and everything."
"That's lovely. Irene spoils you," Nonsense. She deserves to be spoiled. Tansy started to open the cellophane wrapper. I remember only too well back when Amos passed. It helped getting the funeral behind me. But then you feel the gaping hole they leave behind more than ever. It's not easy. None of it is easy. There just seems to be a mountain of stuff to sort out. Financial, insurance, notifying everyone from the local council to the bank. Every day I think of 100 more jobs I need to do. Plus the rest of it I can't talk about. Irene nodded. You'll get through it. Don't expect too much of yourself. If you want me to help with your to-do list, you've only to say, and Tansy is always welcome up here, you know that. Have you heard how Alex is doing? He's okay. They've found him a new foster family. The woman introduced herself to me at school, and she seemed nice enough. That's good. I do miss seeing him around. I wanted to say I'm here for you too, Kate. Anytime you want to talk about Michael or just to get things off your chest, you only have to say the word. She looked at me pointedly. I really mean that. Thank you. There is something that's bothering me. I glanced at Tansy, aware that just because she didn't look like she was listening, it was no guarantee that she wasn't. The detectives called at the house again.
Oh, really?
Irene looked surprised. I was taken aback too. Anyway, they wanted to ask me if I'd noticed anything different about Michael, his mood, anything like that. I said he'd been down and seemed worried, and that it was no wonder because he'd felt a bit hounded by the police.
Quite right, she agreed,
and for no other reason than that he worked here at Wadebridge. Exactly, but then they told me they were investigating another missing person, Jakub Jasinski. Irene hesitated.
How odd.
Yes, I thought so. I told them he worked here as a labourer for a couple of years, and that he just didn't turn up for work one day. That's what happened, isn't it? Irene was quiet for a moment. Then she said,
I can't recall, dear. Michael dealt with the casual labourers, as you know. I knew nothing about that side of things.
But Jakob had been around for a long time. He was always out in the fields, but I'd seen him enough to know who he was, so Irene must remember something. Michael told the police he didn't know a Jakub Jasinski, I said. I asked him why he'd lied, and he said it was because they'd never leave him alone. But now I'm wondering if there was more to it than that.
Well, if I were you, I'd stop your wondering right away.
Irene regarded me steadily.
Don't give yourself anything else to worry about, Kate. Trust me, you're better off developing a touch of amnesia like me. That way, nobody can catch you out.
I thought it was a strange response. Are you saying you've told the police you can't remember who Jakob is too?
Do you know, I've quite forgotten who's asked me what. Now, shall we have that cup of tea?
Chapter 38. Nottinghamshire Police. D.I. Helena Price hunched over the desk while Brewster flicked through documentation screens on the computer sent by UK Immigration.
So, this is what we've got. A timeline of Jakub Jasinski's arrival into the UK, various sightings, any interaction with public services, GP, stuff like that. He headed up to the East Midlands, and that's where the trail stopped, in terms of the earlier investigation.
Price frowned. No use of credit cards, mobile phones?
He shook his head. Casual workers from Europe mostly don't bother with bank accounts. They deal in cash, at least until they settle somewhere. Their first priority is usually securing some kind of income. Now, Kate Shaw has confirmed that he was at Wadebridge, when Michael Shaw and Irene Wadebridge claimed not to know him.
I think it's time to put on our wellies and have a scout around there.
Brewster nodded and clicked onto another screen. I was hoping you might say that. We've a nice solid lead from the drone exercise the specialist team carried out. I've taken the liberty of creating a visual format on this map. By anticipating the coordinates, I can...
In English, please, Brewster.
I've drawn a circle around the areas that might be of interest to us.
Better. And what did you find?
He pointed to the map. It showed the area known as Wadebridge, with an overlay of pale grey in the shape of a circle. Price peered at the screen and wrinkled her nose.
Looks like quite a big area.
She could almost anticipate the super's reaction, asking her to present evidence as to why digging up Wadebridge seemed like a good idea. Brewster reached for the mouse and hovered over a pin towards the centre of the circle. He clicked, and the map increased in size. Price saw a representation of patchwork fields with a building in the centre. Brewster nodded to the screen.
The drone footage reveals some interesting possible disturbances to the ground. This field right here. I'm wondering if there might be more than Jakub Uzinski's disappearance to interest us up there.
Chapter 39. 1st of December, 2019. Kate. The next day, I let Tansy watch a Disney film while she ate breakfast. It was Sunday, after all, and told her to come and get me when it came to our favourite scene. I sat on the edge of the bed, staring into space, torn between keeping the ring footage and Susie's phone to myself, or telling the police everything. I lost track of time and was shaken out of my trance state by Tansy calling up the stairs.
Mummy, it's the bit where Jasmine flies on the magic carpet.
She sounded half-hearted, as if she hadn't the energy to shout. Startled, I jumped up off the bed and made for the door. I felt guilty I'd just left her downstairs. I rushed downstairs and ground to a halt at the bottom. There was a white envelope face down on the mat.
Mummy! Tansy yelled. Come on! Coming! I called back in a high, sing-song voice.
I picked up the letter and turned it over in my hands. Printed in neat block capitals was my name, Kate Shaw. I slid my finger under the seal and ripped it open. Inside was an A4 sheet of plain paper that had been precisely folded. The contents of the letter had been typed, F-A-O Kate Shaw. There are a large group of people in this village who believe you know what your husband, Michael Shaw, did with that poor young woman. The reputation of this village is being ruined. Increasingly, numbers of people, and now the press, are landing here every day to try and find out what happened and help solve the mystery. We have solid reasons to believe you know everything. For the sake of your daughter, and for the preservation of our village life, please speak up. Do the right thing and tell the truth. And then go. Please go away and find a home somewhere else. You are no longer welcome here. Collectively, Linwick Village residents. I crumpled the letter and released it, as if it were poison on my fingers. It fluttered to the floor. They really believed that Michael had harmed Susie Barros and that I had information and was protecting him. I felt outraged until I realised that's exactly what I was doing. What were the solid reasons they thought they had? Nobody knew about Susie's phone but me. And if the villagers suspected my involvement somehow, were the police just one step behind? And who had Paul been gossiping to about Michael having a thing going on with Susie? I was going to have to speak to Donna about it, and I could guarantee it wouldn't go down well. Tansy appeared in the hallway, her little arms folded, her mouth pursed with impatience. This tiny girl who needed me now more than ever.
Mummy, when are you going to... Oh, what's this?
She dashed forward, her hand outstretched to the crumpled ball of paper at my bare feet.
Leave it!
I yelped, and she jumped back, snatched back her hand, startled.
Sorry, darling, it's just rubbish. Don't touch it.
Tansy shrank back, and I saw how much more nervous she'd become. She had a new fear of the unknown, a newly developed expectation that bad things could happen.
Sorry, it's okay. No need to be scared. It's just... Let's go and watch Jasmine fly, shall we?
She took my hand, and we walked back into the living room.
She set the movie playing again and kept glancing at me to see if I was paying attention. My face told her I was, but my mind told a different story. That note had been well written. It had been considered and thought through. These were not people who threw bricks through windows or posted dog mess through the letterbox. They were far cleverer than that, but their words were just as lethal and damaging as any physical act of aggression. My daughter and I were surrounded by them, once people who we'd lived happily amongst, but that now wanted us gone. I'd been party in the past to the insidious ways they achieved what they wanted. I'd heard about the secret meetings organised when a neighbouring village wanted to share use of the village hall, the way certain actions were planned, but no minutes or attendance recorded. They had consulted private legal advisers a few years ago, when the then head teacher of the primary school put forward a proposal to change the timings of the school day. The school governors voted unanimously against his plans, and 6 months later he tendered his resignation to pursue other interests. These were people who did not come out and speak their truth. Instead, they preferred to work covertly behind the scenes, using their imagination and contacts to reach their desired outcome. And it usually worked. I could probably hazard a reasonable guess at who the people behind the note were. Mums at school, members of the parish council, prominent business owners in the area. But I'd never know for sure. I'd never know if the person making me a sandwich in the local bakery was someone who was part of the village collective who'd signed that letter. And that made Linwick a dangerous place for us to be, and a toxic place for Tansy to grow up. I don't know. Maybe if I was outside looking in, I too would find it hard to believe a wife could be so gullible and unsuspecting. I might suspect she was protecting her husband in some way. I snuggled in close to Tansy's warm little body, desperate for comfort. Our daughter, full of goodness and kindness. "To the best daddy in the world," we used to write in all Michael's birthday and Father's Day cards, because it had been true. I'd believed that with all my heart, but now I couldn't get past all the evidence that was stacking up. I felt the weight of all the questions and difficult conversations that were still ahead of me bearing down. After the film, I fixed Tansy a glass of milk and a biscuit, and she settled down to draw Princess Jasmine flying away on her magic carpet. I sat down at the kitchen table with a coffee, my head in my hands, allowing myself 5 minutes of hopelessness. I kept thinking about Susie and Jakub, the fact that they'd both been at Wadebridge, the fact that they were both Polish, the fact that Michael had known them both. And still, it made no sense whatsoever. Donna and Ellie came over mid-afternoon. Soon, the girls were playing with a tea set and Tansy's soft toy brigade while we sat at the breakfast bar. I made coffee and set the biscuits Donna had brought with her on a plate. "Are you feeling okay?" Donna narrowed her eyes as she regarded me with concern. "I can see you're troubled, and no wonder. You're grieving." I nodded. "Just being up at Wadebridge yesterday for the first time without Michael there, it was so odd, so strange. It never goes away. You just have to learn to live with it." She looked away towards the light of the window. "Even now, I wonder if we'll ever be able to find Matilda and put her to rest. Losing her will stay an open sore until we find out what happened. I pray we can do that before Mum goes." I wrapped my arms around her. "The police have been again," I whispered in her ear. "They're gearing up the investigation into Jakub Jasinski. He was a labourer who worked at Wadebridge. Michael told me he'd left about a year ago with no explanation, and although they haven't said as much, the police seem to think foul play may have been involved."
"No. Are you saying they're putting Michael in the frame for his disappearance too?"
Again, the urge to confide in Donna about finding Susie's phone surged up in me, looking for a way out. I felt so desperate to unburden myself, but I couldn't do it without finally sealing the suspicions about Michael. I fought it back down inside.
Michael lied to them. I was there when he said he'd never heard of Jakob, and Irene is also being cagey about him, says she can't recall his name. I'm really scared Michael had something to do with him going missing.
I reached into my pocket and pulled out the letter from the villagers that I'd flattened out and refolded. This was pushed through the door earlier. Donna scanned the contents, her eyes widening and then darkening with anger.
Do you know who wrote this? They have no right!
I shook my head and signalled for her to keep her voice down in front of the girls. I'm sure I can guess some of the people behind it, just as you could. What bothers me are the solid reasons they refer to. Imagining what's being said is worse than actually knowing.
I can't imagine how you're feeling, with even more trouble landing at your door like this. I can see your pain, and I can see how it's affecting Tansy.
I heard myself speak before I could censor it. Donna, I wanted to let you know that Tansy was so upset the other day. Ellie had said she'd overheard you and Paul talking. She told Tansy he'd said Michael had a girlfriend, and it was Susie.
Oh, no.
Donna paled.
No, that's not right, Kate. Ellie must have got confused. I'd absolutely remember if he'd said something like that.
And there it was, strong as ever, the old denial that Paul could possibly do anything wrong. I knew for a fact Ellie was too young to make something like that up. She'd heard it, and then innocently repeated it to Tansy. That much was obvious. But really, what was the point in arguing about it? And there was the small detail that Paul was dead right. I couldn't deny it any longer after the new evidence I had uncovered. And yet, there was something inside, some tiny thing, you could call it naive or just plain stupid, that was forcing me to hold on to a wisp of hope that Michael was innocent of all wrongdoing. Is that what we all did when our backs were up against the wall? Cling on to the tatters of what we wanted, needed, to continue to believe? If we'd spent years investing ourselves, our entire lives, and those of our children into the integrity of someone, did we fall apart too if that person was found to be a stranger, a monster in our midst? If Michael had committed atrocious crimes, then I'd been living that lie too. I glanced over and watched my daughter, absorbed in play, yet far from the happy-go-lucky girl she'd been before. There was no doubt about it. Tansy was struggling with the death of her father. That would only be made 100 times worse if the police found something bad had happened to Jakob as well as Susie. And if they became convinced I knew something, well, it didn't bear thinking about what could happen.
Chapter 40. Irene
had just woken up from a pleasant 10-minute doze when Doris bustled through and told her there was someone here to see her.
"It's those two detectives," she whispered. "I said you were resting and could I help, but they said they really needed to speak with you because you own the land."
"That's all right, Doris," Irene said, not remotely agitated. "You can bring them through. Offer them some tea." Doris nodded and disappeared. Irene sat back and took in the view of the garden and the fields beyond. Doris was doing a good job in Susie's absence. She was a hard worker and dependable, and looked to Irene for guidance in every aspect of her work in the house. It was most satisfying, and it occurred to Irene that perhaps she should have gone for a more mature lady as a home help before now. The younger ones just brought trouble, it seemed. She looked up as Doris led the two detectives into the room. She'd spoken to these two before a couple of times, helped them with general queries, but Michael had been at her side then.
"Hello again, Mrs. Wadebridge."
D.S. Brewster was larger than life and a little too bold for Irene's liking.
"Nice to see you, Mrs. Wadebridge."
D.I. Price smiled and nodded behind him.
"Please sit down," Irene said. "What can I do for you?"
They sat, and Price folded her hands neatly together.
"As you know, Mrs. Wadebridge, we've been working hard on investigating the disappearance of Susie Barros."
"I do indeed know that," Irene nodded. but not had much luck in finding her, as I understand it. She saw Brewster wince. Well, we think that might be about to change, Price said. We're also very invested in solving the disappearance of Jakub Jasinski, who we believe worked here as a labourer for a considerable length of time. As I've said before, Michael dealt with all that, Irene said firmly, picking up her cup.
Brewster leaned forward. We wanted to ask you about that particular detail, Mrs. Wadebridge. How were the casual labour paid? Were they on the payroll, or was it a more informal arrangement?
Again, that was Michael's domain, Irene said regretfully. I'm sure I don't know what I'm going to do without him.
Brewster nodded. Well, we're here today to tell you about an exercise we've carried out remotely using the police drone.
Irene looked at him blankly.
Are you familiar with drones, Mrs. Wadebridge?
Brewster's voice softened a little.
Would you like me to explain to you what they are?
If you mean one of those unpiloted aircrafts that can carry out a number of procedures, ranging from delivery of packages to assisting in police and military operations, then no. I think I'm up to speed, thank you. Irene said mildly. You have to have a license to use them, apparently. She noticed D.I. Price attempt to smother a smirk. It had to be said that Irene didn't see much of the world outside the village these days, but she did listen to informative radio programmes and read the newspapers to keep up to date with what was going on. She had several papers delivered daily, from highbrow publications that stuck to the salient facts through to the more playful editions that kept her abreast of the latest celebrity news and what was good to watch on television. It never failed to amuse her how people, especially men, it had to be said, seemed to assume she needed everything explained in a simple, drawn-out manner, despite her having lived, in some cases, twice as long as them.
Oh, that's grand. Impressive, that. Brewster coughed. So, we used a drone to survey the land surrounding Wadebridge, and we discovered some interesting possible anomalies in the topography of...
The land looks as if it's been disturbed in one of the fields at some point, Price provided.
Disturbed?
Irene raised an eyebrow. Well, it's hard to tell. The field is ploughed, not grassed. Was that something Michael would have overseen? She nodded. I rent some of the fields out to local farmers for arable land. Have done for years. She stared out of the window towards the very area they were discussing. Brewster unfolded an aerial photograph and pointed out an area outlined in red.
This is the field in question.
Irene reached for a small wooden box. Opening the lid only slightly, she pushed in her hand, making a satisfied sound before pulling out her reading glasses. Slipping them on, she peered down at the photograph before taking them off again.
Oh, yes. I kept that field, she said. It isn't one that's rented out. Well, we'd like to investigate the land further, Brewster said. Is that something you'd be happy for us to do, Mrs. Wadebridge?
Certainly, Irene said without hesitation. You must do whatever it takes to bring that young boy's mother back. If the fields might hold some clue, although I dread to imagine what, then go ahead with my blessing.
Chapter 41. Nottinghamshire Police.
Well, that was easier than I anticipated, Brewster said as they walked back to the car. The old deer seemed quite open to the dig.
It was also interesting that the old deer defined a drone in far more eloquent terms than you'd have managed, Helena teased. Best not to underestimate our Mrs. Wadebridge, I reckon, Brewster. She finds it convenient to pass everything off as Michael's responsibility, but in my opinion, she's far too canny and curious not to keep up to speed on what's happening on her own land. Helena stared at the row of cottages as they approached their vehicle. They were all empty now, the only movement being yellow police tape that fluttered in the light breeze, the breadth of the fields serving as a barren backdrop to their damp, dark stone and shadowy vacant windows. She shivered and got into the passenger seat of the car. She was a pragmatic woman who unswervingly based all her theories and assumptions on fact. but she'd bet a year's salary that something bad had happened in this place. She felt it in the chill on her face, in the eerie silence of the land. She could swear she felt it in her very bones. Next, as they'd planned, even if they got Irene Wadebridge's approval, they headed back to the station to apply for a warrant.
"Just in case our Mrs. Wadebridge changes her mind," Brewster murmured.
"Once the warrant comes through, we've got what we need to go ahead," Helena agreed. Brewster thought aloud as he navigated the roads.
"I know you don't rate gut feeling as a method of detection, boss, but what's your feeling about Kate Shaw? Do you think she knows anything about what her husband may have done? His likely involvement in the disappearances of Susie Barros and Jakub Jasinski?"
Helena grimaced, considering the question, as Brewster stopped at traffic lights. "Honestly, Brewster, I'm not sure yet. I couldn't come down on a definite yes or no. How about you?"
"Same, I suppose. If it turns out Shaw did away with one or both of them, I can't believe his wife would be so gullible and unobservant as to not notice at least some odd behaviour. Stuff wasn't quite adding up."
"I'm pretty sure she would," Helena said as they set off again. "The question is, would she confide any of that to us? Or is she simply keeping it to herself in the hope that we won't reach a damning conclusion about her late husband?"
"Perhaps she might show her true colours when we tell her about the excavation plans," Brewster suggested.
Helena nodded. "I guess we'll soon find out." Later, on her way home from the station, Helena pulled up outside a small, semi-detached house in Hucknall, the nearest town to Linwick, where Brewster had arranged her an appointment.
"The Hansons are an experienced foster family that social services use for difficult or unusual temporary placements," Brewster had explained to her, following his chat with Alex Barros's social worker. "Their own children are grown up, and they only take one child at a time, so all their attention and focus can be applied. They thought it was the ideal solution for Alex to come here."
The middle-aged woman who answered the door had very long brown hair that was parted like curtains over a wide, friendly face. "Hi, I'm Janet Hansen," she said with a smile. "Come on in. Alex is drawing at the kitchen table. Turns out he's quite a talented artist." She led them down a short hallway into a bright, airy, extended kitchen with French windows and a seating area. A balding, wiry man with a moustache and wearing Birkenstocks and loose linen trousers stood up and stepped forward.
"Bill Hansen," he said.
"Hello, I'm D.I. Helena Price. Thanks for agreeing to me calling at such short notice." "It's no trouble," Janet said pleasantly. "I'll make some tea. Chamomile or green leaf or English breakfast?" "The English breakfast would be great, thank you." She walked over to the table. "Hi, Alex." She bent forward to inspect the detailed drawing he seemed engrossed in. "That looks great. A tractor."
"It's a plough," Alex said. "Bill took me to see one in a field."
He pointed to a complicated-looking roller at the front.
"This part rakes the soil and breaks up the lumps."
He looked over at Bill, who gave him an approving thumbs up.
"He's bright, this lad. Applies himself."
Helena sat down next to the boy. "Looks like you're doing a great job there." It was good to see the boy engaging with people around him without having to be coerced, like had happened last time at Kate Shaw's house.
"I like drawing," he said. "I had an art set at my house in Poland. There were 6 pencils in it, all with different types of lead. They were very good for drawing."
Helena raised an eyebrow. Alex seemed like a different boy. Take a kid who felt vulnerable and nervous and make them feel secure, and they bloomed like a flower. The Hansons were obviously doing a great job with him. Janet placed a glass of juice in front of him, and he paused in his drawing to thank her. Helena saw her chance.
"Alex, do you think you could stop what you're doing just for a few minutes so we can talk?"
He put his pencil down carefully and reached for the juice. He turned slightly in his chair to look at her.
"Have you found my mummy yet?"
"I'm afraid not," she said, "but we're hoping you might be able to help us. Last time we spoke, we talked about life back in Poland and the things you missed about it. But now I'd like you to think back to the days before your mum went missing. How did she seem to you? Was she happy here in England?"
Alex thought for a moment, then said,
She was happy in England, but she was worried about stuff too. She said soon we could find a nicer place to live.
Did she mean nicer than Wadebridge? He nodded.
I think so.
I know your mum got on well with Irene, didn't she? And Michael too. Why do you think she wanted to move away from the cottage you rented there?
She didn't like Michael, he said, touching the side of his glass absently. But she said she had to be nice to him.
I see, Helena said. And did she say why?
No. She liked Kate, but not Michael.
She got on well with Kate, didn't she?
Alex nodded. She said Kate was nice. She also said that if I was ever in trouble and she wasn't around, someone would be looking out for me.
Who do you think she meant, Alex?
He looked down.
I don't know.
Helena felt a sharp pang in her chest, as if she might have hit on something. She needed to pursue the possible lead, but there was a risk attached. The boy could either crack open or close right down.
I'm wondering why your mum might have said that.
She paused and looked at Alex. Alex stared down at the table.
Perhaps she was worried you might be upset, so she kept some things a secret. My mum didn't keep secrets from me,
Alex said, his face darkening.
It's okay if she did, Alex, Helena said calmly. Perhaps she thought you were too young, that you'd get upset. She told me everything. She said I was old enough to know everything.
Helena nodded. That's good. She told you everything, but she didn't tell you the real reason she left Poland, and she didn't tell you why she didn't like Michael Shaw. There was a tense silence. And then, suddenly, just as Helena had decided the boy wasn't going to say any more, he stood up, his fists balled, two spots of colour flaring in his cheeks.
She was looking for her friend Jakub,
he yelled, the buried anger and frustration pouring out of him.
Michael knew where Jakub was, but wouldn't tell her. He was talking to her at the Christmas lights, and he made her cry. Then Mummy went away.
Tears ran unchecked down his cheeks.
But she hasn't come back, and it's been ages.
It's okay, Alex, Helena said kindly. Don't get upset about it. You've done nothing wrong, and you've helped us so much. We're going to do our very, very best to find your mum.
Chapter 42, 2nd of December 2019. Kate. The day after the funeral, I'd arranged with the school to return to my part-time teaching assistant role this Monday. I'd so missed the children and the contact with the other staff, but after the delivery of the sinister letter, and with several of the school staff living in or close to the village, I also felt more than a bit on edge. Our routine had always been that on the mornings I worked, I dropped Tansy off a little early in the library, with Miss Monsall's permission, so I could meet with the teaching assistant who organised our hours and the reading rota. I sat in the staff room now, teachers milling around me, collecting their mail from pigeonholes, chatting about planning, and grabbing a quick coffee before the start of class. One or two people smiled and nodded. I knew their faces, but I was only friendly with the teachers in years 5 and 6, because it was those classes I worked in. My attention was caught by a small group of staff in the corner. I felt certain I'd seen a couple of furtive glances darted over towards me before the low hum of voices resumed. Was I becoming paranoid because of the letter? For all I knew, it was just a handful of spiteful people trying to make trouble for me. I'd always got on well with my school colleagues, and I was sure I'd done the right thing coming back here, despite my initial doubts. I just needed to relax and get used to being around people again. That was all it was. The staffroom door opened, and Jill Chilton came in. I'd worked with Jill for the last 3 years, since the last teaching assistant who'd organised the class rotas retired. Jill did a great job and was friendly and approachable. She scanned the room and saw me, coming straight over to where I sat.
Kate, she said, sitting down next to me and smiling. How are you? I was so, so sorry to hear about Michael. How are you and Tansy bearing up?
We're just trying to get through each day, I suppose, I said,
not wanting to linger on Michael's death. Tansy is being so brave, and Miss Monsall says she's trying really hard in class.
That's good to hear, Jill said, glancing over at the group in the corner. Really good.
There were a few moments of silence that I felt moved to fill. I'm looking forward to getting back into the swing of things, I said. Will I be working in the same class, or...
That's exactly what I've come over to talk to you about, Jill said, pressing her lips together. We've had a bit of a rejig of the reading rotas in your absence, and actually, well, we've realised we don't really need you for the rest of the term. We thought you might appreciate the break with so much happening.
Honestly, time on my hands is the last thing I need. I gave a nervous laugh. I'm looking forward to working with the kids again, Jill. I've really missed it.
You've been such a valued member of our rota team. We're so grateful for what you've done for the children.
Her placatory words definitely had the ring of the past tense about them. What was she trying to tell me exactly? This was more than a rejig, as she put it.
I get the feeling decisions have already been made, I said slowly. I just wonder why.
I'm so sorry, Kate. It's out of my hands. Jill had the grace to look embarrassed. She was obviously the messenger for a decision that had been made at a higher level.
We can review it again next term, okay?
My heart was racing, and I felt sure my cheeks must be flushed, but I kept my voice level.
Look, I'm here now. Can I be of some use at least? It doesn't have to be reading.
I looked around the room, suddenly aware that the hum of conversation had dropped to virtually nothing. More glances were definitely being sent my way.
I really appreciate your offer, but that won't be necessary, Jill said.
It was obvious from her tapping foot and restless hands she was cringing inside, but her manner had become a touch more formal.
I apologise that you've had a wasted journey. I think they could have decided all this before your first morning back.
I stood up, angled my body away from the staff so they couldn't see my face.
When you say they, who do you mean exactly?
She hesitated, as if she was considering whether to say something. Then, as if she'd resigned herself to the fact I wasn't going to be fobbed off, said,
The head teacher and the governors. The official line is that it's no longer appropriate for you to be working in school. I'm sorry, Kate.
I heard whispers behind me and wheeled around, suddenly furious that they were acting like kids out in the playground.
What? I said loudly, looking around. If you've something to say, then have the guts to say it to my face at least.
Everyone seemed to suddenly find their own feet and hands fascinating. Eyes swiveled away from me. People turned back to their mail and planning sheets.
She's got some front. I heard someone murmur close by.
Then I knew. Somehow, they'd heard about the police interest in Michael's involvement in Susie Barros's disappearance, and possibly Jakub Jasinski's. More worryingly, they seemed to think I was somehow involved in that too. I got back home just as Tansy would be starting her first lesson of the day. I felt as though my chest had caved in. I shut the front door behind me and sat down on the stairs, dropping my head low to try and stave off the nausea I'd felt sure would knock me off my feet on the walk home. Everything Jill had said to me had seemed on the face of it to be perfectly reasonable. They'd had a reorganisation. They didn't need me to work in class until at least next term. Both she and I knew the real reason that was swimming under the calm surface of her patter. Rumours were lurking in school and on the streets about Michael. About me. They didn't want the hassle that would inevitably come from parents concerned about a suspected criminal's wife having unsupervised contact with their children. The author of that letter might well have been one of the school governors themselves. I had no means of fighting back. I was a temporary part-time classroom reading assistant with a 0 hours contract. I hadn't got a leg to stand on. The sound of the doorbell made me spring to my feet, my heart lurching in my chest. I didn't look through the peephole. I just opened the door.
"Morning, Mrs. Shaw," D.I. Price said briskly. Sorry to turn up like this, but can we have a minute?
Wordlessly, I stepped back so they could enter the hall. As I closed the door, I saw two mums I knew from school craning their necks and whispering their theories out on the pavement. I didn't offer drinks or ask the detectives to sit down. I just wanted them to say what they'd come to say and leave.
I'm not feeling too good, I said. Will this take long?
No, no, it won't take long at all, Price said, glancing at her colleague.
It's a courtesy call, really, Brewster said, to let you know that we'll be carrying out an organised forensic procedure up at Wadebridge tomorrow afternoon.
I looked blankly at him. Essentially, it's a screened dig by trained officers, Price added.
You're digging for bodies, I said faintly, leaning back against the wall.
We carried out an exercise with the police drone and identified what looks like disturbed ground on one of the Wadebridge fields, Brewster explained. It might be something and nothing, but we've had clearance to investigate further.
And we have the approval of Irene Wadebridge, Price added. I looked up at that. Irene knew what they were doing and hadn't told me. Something washed over me, a sort of panic. My decision to stay quiet gave way to a damage limitation exercise in the face of such a serious police exercise, the dig. Wait here, I said, and rushed upstairs. 2 minutes later, I was back again. I found this, in Michael's toolbox. I thrust the item forward. It's Susie Barros's phone. It has Polish writing on it, and I've seen her with it before. Neither of them reacted for a moment. D.S. Brewster looked at the phone and calmly took a plastic evidence bag from his pocket.
Pop it in there, please, Mrs. Shaw.
I dropped the phone in and wiped my hand on the side of my trousers. When did you discover this piece of evidence, and where exactly? Price said curtly. I found it this morning, just before I took Tansy to school. I was just going to ring you guys when you turned up at the door.
There's a coincidence,
Brewster said. I was, I swear. I needed to change a fuse and I went in Michael's toolbox for a screwdriver, and it was there. The phone was just lying there at the bottom of the toolbox. And you're saying you knew nothing about it until then? Price frowned. You didn't know Michael had Susie Barros's phone?
No, of course I didn't.
I saw Price glance down at my hands, and I realised I'd balled them into tight fists. My armpits were damp, and I kept blinking rapidly. My eyes felt dry and sore. I didn't know, I swear. It was a shock to find it there.
Mrs. Shaw, we'll need to search these premises, Brewster said, taking out his own phone. Are you in agreement for us to do that?
Yes, I mean, it will look bad if I say no, won't it?
The detectives glanced at each other.
There's nothing else here, I'm sure of it.
You didn't know Miss Barros's phone was here until this morning, though, is that right?
Brewster said.
Yes. I mean, no. I didn't know, but there can't be anything else. There just can't.
The detective stood up.
Can we ask that you don't leave the premises, Mrs. Shaw?
Price said. We'll contact headquarters now, and the search and forensics teams should be here shortly.
Of course, I said, my heart battering my chest wall. That's fine. Thank you.
I felt sick with relief they hadn't arrested me. When they stepped out into the hallway, I rushed forward.
Can I be there tomorrow? I blurted out. Can I come to the dig, or isn't that allowed?
We'll be screening the forensic excavation from view, and the field itself will be out of bounds. I'd advise you to stay away, Brewster said shortly.
There's a public footpath running close to the field, so you won't be able to stop anyone who wants to watch, I said.
My heart sank at the idea of word getting out and half the village turning up.
As D.S. Brewster has said, it's best if you stay away, Mrs. Shaw. But if you're determined to attend, then best to let us know beforehand, Price said carefully. We can arrange for someone to accompany you to and from the site.
That's not necessary. I don't need you to... My words petered out when I saw their faces and understood what they'd been getting at.
It might be for the best, Mrs. Shaw,
Brewster said quietly.
Emotions can run high in situations such as this.
They were offering me protection from my own friends and neighbours.
Chapter 43, 3rd of December 2019. I stood at the edge of the field, flanked by two uniformed police officers. We were up at the Wadebridge estate, 3 acres of fields with a main house with a large garden and a row of 5 stone cottages. The place my husband, Michael, had worked for more than 20 years. A sheet of freezing rain arrowed down the back of my neck, trickling down my spine. My jeans were already soaked through, and the raindrops dripped from the tip of my nose and my earlobes. I thought longingly of home, our house being just a 15-minute walk from here. The warmth of the log burner, curtains closed against the weather, and Tansy snuggled into my side as we read the Ichabod together for the umpteenth time this week. In front of me was a different scene. My new reality. White tarpaulin sheets stretched high and wide across the middle section of the field, stark and clinical against the sludge and the moody skies. Behind the screen, I could hear the guttural roar of the yellow digger, its dull black bucket plunging into the depths, forcing the earth to reveal its grim secrets. Powerful spotlights illuminated the area of police interest and the wide circle of land around it. The smell of damp, clogged earth stuck in my nostrils and throat, and I fought the urge to gag. I turned away from the field to look at the people who were standing along the track, a public right-of-way that ran directly behind the row of cottages. They meandered in and out of their small, curious groups, standing and chatting for a minute or two before moving on. I recognised most of the faces that stared boldly back at me without acknowledgement, locals who knew exactly what was happening here. People I used to consider friends and acquaintances who now found themselves unable to express their condolences. People we had lived peacefully alongside for years. Now they'd braved the elements to come and watch our lives crumble as the drama unfolded, the small points of light cast from their phones dancing like sprites in the gloom. Behind me, the press. The constant flashes from the cameras were distracting, and every few seconds I'd hear my name being called with a jarring, unwanted familiarity.
Kate, do you know what they're going to find here? Who's looking after your daughter, Kate? Where's Tansy?
My life was now an open book to these people, a free-for-all. I was no longer a human being. In their eyes, I was subject matter. I was a headline, the star of a grim and gory story everyone wanted to read. I didn't look their way. I didn't give any sign at all that I heard them calling out. I pulled up the collar of my old waxed jacket and shoved my bare hands into the pockets. The fingers of my right hand closed around a soft ball, and my heart squeezed. Tansy's woolen mittens, left in my pocket from a few weeks ago, when we'd walked over here to bring her daddy his sandwiches and to forrow for some yarrow for her flower press. Stomach acid bubbled up into my throat, and I closed my eyes against what was to come, what my 6-year-old daughter would have to face.
Mrs. Shaw, Daily Mail,
a man's voice called out, closer than the others. He sounded friendly, sympathetic.
Did you have any clue at all about what your husband did? We can help you tell your side of the story. Put an end to all the speculation. What do you say?
I didn't turn around. Yesterday, the police had searched the house. I called Donna and asked her to pick up Tansy from school and to keep her last night so I could get things straight after the disruption. It had taken hours. They'd gone through every inch of the house, even lifted carpets and floorboards. They'd emptied the garden shed and virtually dismantled the garage. A huge group of press gathered outside the house, blocking the road and inflaming passing drivers. I didn't leave the house. I sat in a corner of the kitchen and stared out at the garden. I went into the living room twice to peek around the curtains. There were villagers out there, standing around in groups, some with a takeaway coffee from the larder. They talked and looked towards the house with twisted expressions and sneering faces. The police found nothing. They took away items of Michael's clothing and shoes and the family laptop, but there were no startling revelations, no more of Susie Barros's items. I'd felt relieved, but wounded. I'd felt exposed and under fire from the obvious hostility outside the house. The rain pelted down harder now, the biting wind scalding my cheeks, but I welcomed the discomfort. The sound of the digger filled my head with its relentless drone, every second bringing me closer to facing the horror that I dreaded and they all craved. Then, a splutter, the powering down of an engine, and the noise suddenly stopped. For a moment or two, there was perfect silence. Then someone shouted from behind the tarpaulin sheet, a sound of alarm. The gaggle of headline-hungry reporters behind me erupted, surged forward. Cameras flashed so rapidly it almost felt like daylight. Voices rose in unison, all shouting my name and vying for attention, demanding answers. Several officers formed a loose chain behind us to restrain the press. "What's happened?" I whispered hoarsely to my escorts. "Does this mean they've found something?" Neither of the officers responded. A few feet away, D.I. Price talked animatedly on her phone in a low, confidential voice. Before I could get her attention, she ended the call and dashed behind the screen. My sinuses were blocked solid, and I had to drag air in through my mouth. A hum of chatter rose up.
"Have they found something?" a man shouted from the track. "Is it human remains?"
The radio of the officer to my right crackled, and he stepped away to speak into it. Another spurt of crackling, but I couldn't decipher what was being said. I found myself praying silently, "Please, God, don't let them have found her." But the air seemed drenched with a dark foreboding, and I knew it would be bad. Very bad. The officer with the radio returned and whispered something to his colleague. The second man gave a low whistle.
"Jeez,"
he said, shaking his head, clearly appalled.
"What is it? What have they found?"
A wave of panic shunted up and gathered in my chest, choking me like smoke.
"I have a right to know."
The officers looked at each other, and then one of them turned to me, his face impassive.
"You'll find out soon enough, Mrs. Shaw. Don't you worry about that," he said coldly, glancing at the reporters behind him. "I can guarantee that by tomorrow morning, the entire country will be talking about it."
Chapter 44, 4th of December 2019. The morning after the forensic excavation, I woke to everything hurting. My head, my stomach, even my fingers and toes ached. I lay there, feeling like I needed to move, but knowing I couldn't. Not yet. Despite resenting what Paul had said about Michael having a girlfriend in Ellie's earshot, I had to thank my lucky stars yet again for Donna and Paul, who'd also kept Tansy yesterday afternoon and overnight. The telephone rang, and I picked the call up within seconds on autopilot. "Hello?
Mrs. Shaw, this is the Mansfield Sentinel. Have you any comment about the police findings yesterday up at..."
I slammed down the phone. Within seconds, it rang again. I unplugged it at the wall. When I checked my mobile, I had dozens of missed calls, and it was only just after 8 in the morning. Reporters. The police officers had predicted that the results of the police excavation work would be all over the newspapers today. I could hardly remember coming to bed last night. My head was still full of the droning police excavator, the accusatory shouts of the press and the villagers. I'd called around at Donna's house afterwards and dissolved into tears on the doorstep. Donna had ushered me inside. I hadn't realised Tansy was watching from the kitchen, her little face wearing the kind of worried and pained expression that did not belong on the face of an innocent 6-year-old child. In the space of 3 weeks, her ordered, dependable family life had disintegrated into utter chaos. And now this, what effect would it have on her in the future? She'd rushed over and we'd hugged. "I love you so much," I whispered into her clean, soft hair.
Mummy, what's wrong?
She'd whimpered, her little hands clutching at my own.
Mummy's fine, I'd said, kissing her cheek. I'm just not feeling well. I'll be okay after a rest.
Go and play with Ellie, sweetie, and I'll make Mummy a cup of tea, Donna had said. After studying my fake smile critically for a moment, Tansy did as she was told. I could not fault Donna's support in this, our time of need. She was the only person I could really rely on, and I felt infinitely grateful to her. She'd made tea and brought it through.
Is Paul home?
She'd nodded. He's upstairs, which is unusual. He never seems to be home just lately. Her dark eyes betrayed her flippant reply. He's been so good, though, taking time off work to look after Tansy. Donna had pulled a face. That's what I thought, too. But he's been out and about, coming up with excuses why he needs to be out of the house. Like I said, I recognise this behaviour from when he's strayed before. Tell me what happened up at Wadebridge. I'd talked her through the forensic excavation, the awful sounds, the smell of the damp earth, the spectators. I swear half the village turned out to come and have a look. The press were baying like wild dogs. And then when the digger stopped, and it was obvious they'd found something, the police just escorted me away and wouldn't say a word. Do you think they found a body? They must have done. The police were scurrying around, and they couldn't wait to get me out of the way and disperse the crowd. Do you think it's Susie Barros? I'd looked down at my hands and nodded. I can't think about it, Donna. I can't get my head around the fact that Michael had anything to do with something happening to Susie. I just can't. One of the police officers made a comment that it would be all over the press tomorrow. Now, I opened my call list and rang Donna. Her first question was, "Did you manage to get some sleep?" "I'm not sure. I feel like I've been awake most of the night, but I was so exhausted when I got back from your house. How's Tansy?"
"She's fine. They've had breakfast and now they're ready for school. Paul's going to take them in and have a word with Miss Monsell about the police excavation work, in case anyone says anything to Tansy. I've had a little chat to her about letting Mummy rest, and she understands perfectly, so you mustn't worry."
"Thanks, Donna. I don't know what I'd do without you." Paul was another matter. I couldn't work out where his loyalties lay. Then, "How's things your end?" She knew what I meant. "He's in the shower as we speak. He had a few errands and places he needed to call yesterday, apparently," she said, her words dripping with sarcasm. "When I ask where, he answers me like a politician, saying quite a lot, but telling me nothing at all. I'm at the larder all day today, but Paul's stuck at home in Zoom meetings, so at least I have peace of mind where he is. We can chat when I bring the girls over later. Anyway, enough about me. I'm more worried about you. Have you looked online?"
"No, but I'm scared to," I confessed. "I wanted to call you first, and then I'm going to take a look. I'm just terrified of what I might find."
"I've looked," she said. "Do you want to know?"
"Okay," I said, unsure.
"I think it's safe to say people think they've found something. Most likely Susie Barros's body. People are starting to talk about Jakub Jasinski's disappearance too, but everyone seems to be waiting for cast iron evidence." She went quiet.
"It brings it all back. I can't bear to think of what happened to Matilda, but I wanted to look online for you, to save you the anticipation of what you might find."
"I'm so sorry, Donna," I said. "Please don't make yourself feel worse by trying to help me. I've got to face the truth, but I won't talk to the press, and I'm avoiding social media for now. I think you need to be aware, though, Kate. The villagers can be hostile. I hear things, and I'm worried you might be tried and convicted behind closed doors. I know people are speculating that Michael may have killed Susie Barros, and that I've known about it all along." She looked taken aback at my candour.
"It's the stuff of TV crime drama."
I felt panic begin to stir. Our own people had turned against us. Everyone believed Michael was guilty. Now they were trying to drag me into the lion's den. There just wasn't enough space in my head to deal with it.
"I can hear Paul on his phone upstairs," Donna said urgently. I need to listen. I'll let you go. I'll call you soon about picking up Tansy. No worries. They're playing nicely. Gotta go. Speak soon.
I ended the call and swiped down for notifications. My phone screen filled with missed calls and Facebook alerts. I ignored them and went straight to the Sentinel's page. I found what I was looking for in seconds. Remains found in search for missing woman. Forensic officers have unearthed human remains from an area of land known locally as Wadebridge, located on a hillside about a mile from the centre of the historic village of Linwick. Nottinghamshire police have been searching for missing Polish woman Susie Barros, who came over to the UK with her young son over 6 months ago. Barros disappeared after attending the popular Christmas lights turn-on. DI Helena Price, who is leading the Wadebridge investigation, told the Sentinel, "It's too early to